I'm Clint Emerson, and welcome to Season 2 of Can You Survive This Podcast, where the interview is just as dangerous as the scenarios I put my guests through. From hostage situations to natural disasters, carjackings, active shooters, and more, if you're looking for the skills necessary to survive these situations, then this is the show for you. That intro, it always gives me a slight boner. It's so like exhilarating and adrenaline packed and dangerous. But anyway, today we have an awesome guest. He is, it's better than awesome. He's like super awesome. He is a tier one special forces operator. He is a two-time world record breaker, speaker, author, expedition leader, and security specialist. I want to welcome Mr. Dean Stott to the show.
Thank you very much. Cheers, Clint. It's a great intro.
Yeah, there you go.
Even I got a boner.
Did you get the boner too? Okay, good. So yeah, thanks for coming on, man. It's awesome seeing you again. Most people don't know, but we'll go ahead and say it out loud for the first time here. You and I are the new direct staff for a very popular TV show in Australia called SAS Australia, right?
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, I think the embargo's over. I think the cat's out the bag, as they say.
Yeah, yeah. What'd you think about that promo they did for us? Heat,
the raging waters, the untamed wilderness, and two new elite commanders.
My name is Clint Emerson.
He served 20 years as a Navy SEAL in the U.S. unit that took out Osama bin Laden.
We have a saying in Texas, don't mess with Texas, meaning nothing will get in our way. And that is the same attitude these recruits better have.
Dean Stott, I served 16 years in the military. I trained alongside Prince Harry, and I've been trusted to protect his life. This is my new mission.
Now, we're about to set their world on fire.
You know, for me, it's, you know, it's really highlights the world that we live in is that they focus on such minuscule things when it's actually you and I have done so many amazing things before, but they just focus on who you serve with or who you might have friends with in your phone book rather than, you know, the records that you've broken or the millions that you've raised for charity. So, you know, that is the world of media, but that obviously turns heads and puts people on the channel. But hopefully the next promo videos will share a bit more light on our backgrounds.
Yeah, yeah. There was a little, it's always cringy for me when the first thing they do is jump into, you know, a dev group operator, you know, and highlight that piece of my career. And then they loosely tried to tie it to, you know, one of the biggest, you know, military operations that's ever been made public, which I was not a part of, but you know, the way it was done, I was like, oh my God, I think I'm going to vomit. But anyway, you sign a contract and then they get to take all the footage and, you know, do whatever the hell they want with it, which is the scary part, but you know, well.
There's some careful editing as well done in there. There's always some good editing.
Yeah. But like every interview, man, we start off with a little rapid fire to get warmed up and get to know you. And so are you ready?
I'm ready.
All right, here we go. You being a Brit, of course, I throw this in with most Brits, and that is tea or coffee?
Coffee.
I mean, more of them. It's military dudes have turned to the dark side of coffee and gotten away from the tea is what I've noticed. But a majority of England is very tea-based, right?
Oh yeah, it's very tea based. Like my family, my mother, I'm sure she has about 15 cups of tea a day. But I think the caffeine content in tea is a lot less than that of coffee. You know, if I had more than three coffees a day, I'm wired to the moon. So it's limited.
Yeah, that's right. You need it too. Yeah. That's what keeps operations going, right?
Yeah, exactly.
H&K or Glock?
Glock.
Yeah. I know you guys now getting into the British Special Forces, the current weapon of choice is what? H&Ks and Glocks? Or what are y'all guys rolling with these days?
So the UK, so unlike the US military, where you all pretty much have similar weapon systems, whether you're in the Marines or the Rangers, the Green Berets, and all the way through to tier one, ours is separate. So the rest, I call it the Green Army. The Green Army have the SA-80, A2, which is HK components.
Yeah.
And then when we go to Special Forces, we use the C8 DeMarco, and we have the Sig Sauer and the Glock as a secondary weapon. And I think the reason we do that is so should we be captured, we look like Americans, and it's all deniability.
Yeah, because you're C8.
Blame the Americans.
Your C8's is like a 416, right? Or our M4s or our carbines, yeah.
Yeah, it's a Canadian version of the M4, yeah.
Yeah. A lesser weapon.
Okay.
Now this one gets into more, the British SAS SBS history. So canoe or jet boat.
Ooh. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Canoe.
Yeah. I was hoping you were going to say that that is definitely a delineating difference. You have U.S. Navy SEALs, and then you have the British SBS, which is the Special Boat Service, which you are obviously part of. And what I find interesting is we don't, as SEALs, we don't get into canoes or kayaks or any of that as a form of infiltration. We kind of go from diving straight to our jet boats. You guys, though, have this awesome tradition and history where the canoe is a part of your selection and everything, right?
Yeah, well, there was a famous operation back in the Second World War called Operation Frampton, where 10 swimmer canoeists from the SBS inserted into France and destroyed a lot of the shipping in the Bordeaux River. You know, of the 10, two didn't successfully get off the submarine. So, two survived in the end, and they escaped and evaded, stole a bike, got over the Pyrenees and cycled all the way down to Gibraltar. You know, it's a famous operation.
That's so cool.
Where they came in and just put limpet mines on these vessels. You know, there's rumors that that one operation could shorten the war by 6 months. So it's a famous thing. There's a movie called The Cockle Shell Hero. So they inserted on these, they're called Klepper canoes, with wooden frames and these canvas coverings. They're very low profile. And obviously, you know, going up rivers, inserting in those days was covert. We do it on our Special Forces boat corps. You know, we do a week of kleppering. The great thing about the klepper is you can portage it. You can collapse it down and put it into two guys' bergens. You know, it's a two-man canoe, you know, then move across the land and then open up again. It's difficult. It's hard. And we do it in the boat corps just so we know that it is an option if we need it to do that. There was an operation in the last decade, I can't really talk about, where they actually used the Klepper canoe. So what that did is then kept it in service for like another 30 years. So this thing should have been obsolete back in the Second World War. But in the current climate, you know, there's still options that we can use it.
Yeah, I think it's super cool, man. You guys have quite the history, unlike us. We're still the new guys on the block, but man, so fucking cool. All right, rugby or cricket?
Rugby.
Yeah, it's more manly. The cricket thing, I mean, even though it's as popular as it is in, in the UK, I mean, what is more popular? Is it rugby or cricket or soccer or what, football?
So I think soccer is probably more popular in the UK, but rugby's really, in days of old, rugby was seen as the posh schoolboys game, along with cricket, actually. It's one of them ones, it's like, if you didn't have the body and the framework for rugby, you went on the cricket team, and then the rest of the bigger guys went on the rugby. But it was seen as an upper class sport, rugby. But over the years, you know, even when I was at school in the 90s, it was then just starting to come into the more public schools. So rugby's sort of had a big trajectory, and then we won the Rugby World Cup in 2003, which then, you know, put us on the world stage. So I'd say of the three, it would be soccer, rugby, and then the cricket.
Got it. Yeah, here in the U.S., as you know, having you, you've moved here now, you know, like, we're all turn our heads sideways, like, cricket? What the fuck is that? Is that like baseball? But, you know, it's weird with flat bats and it's fucking strange.
Three sticks in the playground. But, yeah, I look at rugby and I see your NFL, you know.
Yeah.
There's always that saying, America is like the sleeping monster. You know, if rugby came here, you guys... But there's just no money in it. That's the big difference in the sports there is, and it's tiered. You know, the soccer in UK is a lot more money than what you get on the rugby pitch.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, money definitely drives the train on what's popular. Okay. Extreme heat or extreme cold?
Extreme cold.
Extreme cold. Yeah. Why is that? You just like warmies? I love warmies.
Yeah, because you can heat yourself up. You know, extreme heat is very difficult to cool yourself down.
That's true. You can't take enough off. You can put enough on, but you never can take enough off.
Exactly. We used to go to Norway every year with the commandos. We used to go to Norway for 3 months. Again, it's post World War. Should the Russians start moving west, we would be there in Norway to sort of help defend. And I always remember in the morning, our instructors are like, start cold. And you're like, really? And it didn't take long. When you're on skis with the big Bergens and the Polks, you soon heated up. I mean, you then started venting off. But then, you know, when you're operating, as you know, in some of the deserts and the jungles and things like that, very difficult to cool down. It's very easy to heat up, but very difficult to cool down.
Yeah, no doubt. It gets to the point where how much you're sweating out it is on the output side outweighs no matter, basically, you're burning more than you can carry at any given point, no matter what you try to do. So you're always deficient on the hydration side. And in fact, they were doing the math. Like if you're carrying your own water and adding that extra weight, just adding the extra weight of water tends to then dehydrate you even more, which is like this huge oxymoron, but it's a math problem that you have to figure out for, you know, desert operations, which is kind of fun.
It's actually quite interesting you say that, because we used to have a lot of guys dehydrated in the Arctic as well, because it's deceiving.
Right.
You're cold, but you are still dehydrating. Yeah. It's hard to find that balance. If anyone knows that balance, I remember one summer doing our special forces selection, and it was a hot summer. And of course, everyone takes on water, as you touched on. You need to take on water. But there was a point where people were taking on too much water that they flushed their electrolytes through and then had the negative effect and were going down anyway. So it's trying to find that sort of balance. So I think we worked out every 3 liters, you put a sachet of electrolytes in. And that was the only way we could sort of manage it in those extreme heats.
Yeah, it's so interesting. The body versus the world, man. And we're going to get into that because you've done some pretty extreme stuff that is certainly your body versus the world. Cycle, run, or row?
Interesting question, that one now. Because obviously I'm a world record cyclist, but I wasn't a cyclist before that. For me, still row.
Row, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I used to ask, like, I've asked other guys, like, run or row, because both of them are kind of like this monotonous thing you do to be in shape, or you add it to your workout regimen, right? And no one thinks about it in terms of like, oh yeah, you know, like you riding across, you know, the whatever, from the fucking tip of South America all the way to Alaska or the Arctic or wherever the hell you went. We're going to get into that. But yeah, to me, it's like all three of them can be boring, you know, but if I had to pick one, I'd always pick run. I don't know. I've always enjoyed just getting out and running, and I feel like I get into a zone with running where I don't with the others.
True.
Last one here, sniper or assault team?
Assault team.
Yeah. I mean, let's face it. That's just kicking doors and shooting people in the face is just fun. In the sniper, I mean, it's a lethal, obviously operational, you know, capability. But I think assaulting is just a lot more fun, right?
Yeah, I think sniper, you're more in control of the environment. You know what I mean? You're in control of that. And I think whereas the assault team, you just don't know what you're kicking the door into, you know, and the landscape quickly changes. Whereas a sniper, you can pretty much see the landscape in front of you.
Yeah.
Unless, however, I do remember a story. So the Royal Marine Sniper Force, which is world famous, they do it at Woodbury Common, just outside Limston, the Commando Training Centre.
Yeah.
And so they have their courses there, but it's also a drop zone. And so one of the lads, when we were parachuting, you know, landed, and next thing was this sniper pair. So when I say you can see your landscape in front of you, you also need to look up as well. You never know who's coming down.
Yeah, that's funny. Yeah, I think, you know, obviously for those experts listening, I'm very aware that snipers are used when you're doing assaults. but it's more like, you know, the adrenaline, the fun. It boils down to fun. Which one's more fun? I think assaulting's more fun than
yeah.
Okay. Let's dive in to you, but I want to kick it off with, what is the most dangerous situation you feel like you've ever been in?
Military or just in general?
Yeah, just in general. Mainly where you've had a lot of lessons learned come out of it, where you're like, whoa, man, wish I would have done this, this, or this, you know?
Yeah, there's one actually, and it's in the prologue and epilogue of my book. It's, you know, so when I was in Afghanistan, we used to work with the, you know, Secret Service, and we used to go pick up Taliban agents. So I used to dress up as a local Taliban and drive into Kandahar and go pick up these agents. So we would do this day in, day out. There's no point in us planning a route because every day, you know, when you go into the city, there'd be roadblocks, there'd be situations. So we knew where we were going and we just had to get there. And what would happen is I'd normally lead vehicle, me and one of my, one of the Afghan SF guys would be in the front of me. You know, we would drive by the target, second vehicle would pick up the target, third would make sure we got no follow-up. You know, those are our normal SOP without giving too much away. So I, you know, we do this day in, day out. There's one day we went into town. The road that we initially wanted to take was blocked. So I then got diverted to right and it was just bumper to bumper traffic. And I just remember people, it was a very narrow market street. There's people walking down the sides of the vehicles and the people were tapping on the window and talking to me. And I would always direct them to Hekmat and he would do the talking. But there was a lot of attention. I don't like anything in my eyes. So I had a nice big black beard, no tan skin, turban, looked the part, but a big beaming blue eyes. So initially I thought, you know, I've been compromised.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I said to the heck man, I think we've been compromised. You know, it came up over the net. So it just goes radio silent. So in my head, I'm thinking, you know, the worst case scenario, as you do, orange boiler suit, CNN tonight, 9 o'clock news, this guy. So in my head, I'm thinking about the IA drill, the immediate action drill, what I need to do. Obviously, I can't divulge that on this show. So, you know, I'm thinking about that. And the initial thing is to grab the weapon under my seat, which is a MP5 Kurtz. So it's got no barrel. And you just empty the magazine 30 rounds into the windscreen. Gives yourself time to grab your weapon and then get on your flip-flops and start heading back to camp, which was about 18 miles as the crow flies from this point. So here's me in my head, you know, going over this situation, you know, planning it out. And just as I was about, you know, during this whole situation, the vehicles are slowly edging forward. So HQ said, on your call, you make the decision. So, okay, as I was just about to grab it, the second vehicle come by around the corner, and my friend Ads, he came up over the net and he's like, stop. So straight away you just drop everything, you know, your whole body just freezes, you know. Yeah. Drop the weapon, and he says your turban's caught in the door. So for me it was like a real life lesson how I misread a situation, but I knew I shouldn't have been there. My senses were so heightened,
yeah,
thinking the worst case scenario, when in fact people have been genuinely nice and trying to help me. So that's a real life lesson for me. In the fact, you know, there wasn't any explosions. It wasn't any shooting. It was just, you know, and I always say it when I do lectures on security and things like that, you know, don't run into a situation. Just step back, have a look. And that's what I didn't do. I was so immersed in it. And I knew that I shouldn't be there. So my senses were heightened. So I wasn't making the right decisions.
I love that story because it supports what I put in the first little book I ever did was Escape the Wolf. And it's an awareness book. And in there, I would talk about like anytime you arrive into a new area, new country, you're going to be oversensitized. Your brain and everything is going to be trying to pay attention to everything because everything in front of you is new. And you're going to think that everything is after you, right? You're going to see ghosts. You're going to see goblins. You're going to see everything that you think you can see. In that environment, when the reality is it's nothing, it's just a new culture, a new place. So you got to almost step back from all of that temporary paranoia, you know, which and just kind of drive forward, but keep your wits about you at the same time. But man, that's a fucking great example of what I've talked about in there. You're listening to Can You Survive This Podcast? Thanks for tuning in. Please make sure to subscribe, rate, and share on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your favorite shows. Okay, now let's get into a little bit about where you're from, you grew up, yeah, and all that good stuff, and how you led yourself to the special operations world.
Yeah, so I was born into the military. My father was in the military. My grandparents were in the military. A lot of history within the family. So I was born into that environment, very much immersed in it. I grew up in a town called Aldershot. So it's probably the equivalent. It was the home. Aldershot is the home of the British Army. So it's the equivalent of growing up in Fort Bragg, I guess. There was parachutists everywhere. You know, everywhere you look was military vehicles. People wearing military uniforms. That was just the normal day to day. But it wasn't forced upon me to continue that family tradition. But when I left school, I wanted to be a fireman, and I was too young to be a fireman. I still needed, I didn't want to do any further education. So I told my father that I wanted to join the military. And I was expecting some of those warm, comforting words and advice, but I was basically told that I would last 2 minutes, which wasn't the response I expected. But at 65 kilos and 5'7" at the time, I hadn't fully grown. I could see where my father was coming from. But, and one of the things I do, there's no point in taking on board what he said and letting it eat you away. The best thing to do is actually go prove him wrong and come back to the table later. So that's what I did. I joined the military. My father was Royal Engineers. So I joined the Royal Engineers as was he, because he was teaching me how to get as much back from my time in the military, trades, qualifications and things like that. He didn't think I would be a career man. He thought it was probably about 3 to 5 years at the most. So I joined the Royal Engineers at the age of 17. By the age of 21, I was a para commando, a diver, a PTI. I'd done every arduous course within the Royal Engineers. But yeah, this time I'd also grown. I'd grown into the figure that I am now. But I was just getting more confident each time I did a course. It was like, I didn't know about the SBS, never even heard of the SBS. Or the Royal Marines, because where I was an airborne town. It was the SAS and the parachute regiment.
Right.
If you had a recruitment office there, it would have got burnt out. And so I joined the commandos. I ended up serving in Brigade Recce Force for 8 years, which is the commando reconnaissance. And so for me, my career was sort of narrow in one way. It was special forces. But coming from the army, the only option in the days of old was the SAS. The SBS was 100% from the Royal Marines. Mm. But a Royal Marine could join the SAS. So the SBS were missing the trick there in the fact that they were losing candidates to the SAS from the from the Royal Marines, because they may not like diving. And so all of a sudden opened up tri-service. So at the time, I was I'd served 8 years in Free Commander Brigade with the Green Beret, working alongside the Royal Marines. And I was now the senior diving instructor at the Defence Diving School down in Portsmouth. So for me, it was the natural option to go that route. So I applied for the Special Boat Service. And just so your listeners are aware, so there's no distinction between SBS and S. Of course, it's joint. It's UK Special Forces. Right. So one's not, it's Delta and SEAL Team 6, obviously different courses. No, ours is exactly the same. So there's no easier or harder course. Mm-hmm. But you make the decision which one you're going on. So I decided I was going SBS, much to the disgust of all my friends in the SES, who had lots of them there.
Yeah.
And you can imagine when you're on, on selection, part of selection is being the grey man as much as possible.
Hell yeah.
On a 6-month course, I was a grey man for 2 minutes. My name was the first name that they called out. And it was like, why the hell are you going SBS? I ignored it anyway. I was successful, passed selection, became one of the first army candidates to do so. But I think now 15% of the SBS is now from the army. So it just opened up the door to others that there are those possibilities. And then for us, when it then came to operations, when we're at the height of the war of terror with Iraq and Afghanistan, SAS were in Iraq and the SBS were in Afghanistan. So, naturally we were getting guys recruited through selection because of the theaters that we were operating in.
Yeah, that's interesting. We've always, the U.S. Special Operations for a very long time always followed the lead of British Special Operations because it'd been around for such a long time. You guys had already, done trial and error with command structure and, operations and, just everything that you have guys done. I find it interesting that the selection course is combined. And my guess is, JSOC is probably, I would have to guess they might do the same thing someday. I never heard rumors of it or anything, but it kind of makes sense. You know, you let the guys go where their passion takes them. There's no sense in keeping an Army guy away from maritime operations if that's what he wants to do. And likewise, a SEAL, if he wants to go do more, you know, ground-based operations and doesn't like the water anymore, then he should be able to, you know, which he can. Like, you have SEALs that go over to the Army side, but the SEAL side doesn't accept anybody except SEALs. And it's a strength and it's a weakness, but I find it interesting. I think, you know, the combined selection and that standardization and continuity is important.
And we also work together a lot, the SAS and SBS. We're not as big as Americans, so we actually work alongside each other. Yeah. So you know that you've got the same sort of training. You know you've all gone through that same process. Yeah. But the irony is, actually, there was a period of time when Afghan and Iraq was on that the SBS were more current on mobility and jumping, and the SAS more current on water operations, just purely because of the theaters that we were in.
Yeah.
But that all stemmed back from that. That started, so 40 years this year is the Falklands War, where the Brits went down and took the Falklands back from the Argentinians. Mm-hmm. At that period, the SBS was Navy Special Forces, which still is, and the Army was SAS, but they weren't talking to each other. And the only fatality they had the SBS was a blue-on-blue with the SAS. So post-Falklands War, they were like, we need to know what you guys are doing, So they then formed UK Special Forces and then brought them together. So they then knew, everyone on the chessboard rather than sort of guess where everyone was. So there's pros and cons to it.
Right,
but
right.
As you know, there's always the history. There's always the history of the units.
Yeah.
You know, which you never get away from.
Yeah. You know, interesting when you talk about time, 40 years ago, the Vulcans, right? That you just mentioned.
Vulcans, yeah.
Yeah, 40 years ago is when the SEAL teams were invented for us.
Yeah.
So it's like, okay, yeah, you guys have been around a little longer. Okay, so moving on into your career, you get through selection, you get to the SBS. Mm. What was the most standout kind of moment for you? It can be anything. It doesn't have to be combat or anything, but just that moment when you're like, oh, yeah, I'm here. I've made it.
Yeah, I think, you know, I'm very I'm a competitive person. I always like to push myself. And I sort of, I remember having done 6 months selection, and then we do 3 months of boating and diving. So it's like 9 months in total. Mm-hmm. And you're like, you're on top of the world. You're like, you know, I've made it. I mean, day one, you're almost, you're back. You're like, you're the brew bitch, you know, go get the kettle off.
Yeah.
And it sort of really, it really grounded me. And I thought, yeah, in fact, actually, you're now just starting your career. But for me, just that initial looking around the room, having known what these guys have gone through, similar to yours, you just got that immediate respect for them. And I thought, I'm now in a group of like-minded individuals. And for us, we're not the ones who have the shiniest, we're definitely not the ones who have the shiniest boots and the smartest uniforms and things like that. We're pretty much the rogues, you know what I mean? Yeah. We are. And I was like, you know, I then, that was for me a real eye-opener that I'd come home, as they say. I've found my place.
Yeah, I agree. It's kind of the same for us. You know, there is this story that supposedly it was when George Bush Jr., you know, was president, and he had choices. GW, okay, so GW is given choices from time to time, and there was this rumor going around that they'd say, hey, do you want, you know, the Army guys or do you want the Navy guys? And he was like, well, which ones are the Boy Scouts? And they're like, oh, that's the Army guys. Oh, okay, I'll get the Navy guys to go do that job. So, you know, the frogman world is definitely rogue. It's definitely been known for, you know, like you said, our boots were never bloused. They were never shined. Heck, our uniforms probably don't even match. But we don't care about, you know, it's like we don't care about that stuff. We just get the job done.
Yeah,
and true. That's what matters. But so you get through this career. I'm sure there's a hundred stories you could tell. But I kind of want to get into your double world record breaker, right? So cycling based, so tell me about that and how you decided, I'm just going to go ahead and go south and then ride all the way north.
Yeah, so I'll have to fill in a little bit of a gap. Yeah. So I did 16 years. I got injured out of Special Forces, had a hey-ho parachute accident. So
right.
Tore my ACL, my MCL, my lateral meniscus, my hamstring, my calf, my quad. Couldn't operate anymore. So everything I'd ever known from a young boy growing up in Aldershot to 16 years in the military. So like, no, thank you for your service. It's time to move on. So I never planned on leaving the military. But without sounding like Liam Neeson, people with our skill sets, you know, the natural progression is the private security industry. And so I left the military prematurely. Alana, my wife, was 8 months pregnant. So the pressures of how am I going to support my family? Thankfully for me, within 48 hours of leaving, I got a job out in Libya. It was May 2011, the Arab Spring. And helping set up one of the British Embassy projects over there. But sort of going back to what you touched on earlier, when you go into these countries and you sort of, you know, absorb the atmospherics and what you're doing, I soon identified the Libyans didn't want it being another Afghan or Iraq. You know, they wanted to take control of Libya once Gaddafi had fallen. But also that these larger private security companies were charging 6-7-figure sums for these crisis management and evacuation plans. But when I actually scraped the surface, there was nothing in place, which is very current with what we've just seen lately in Afghanistan. So I flew home. Alana gave birth to Molly, and I was trying to find a niche within the industry. All my friends that had left were all now just cleaning up on the east coast of Africa doing the anti-piracy. Mm-hmm. So I went back into Libya, and I bought, there's a huge proliferation of weapons. I bought 30 weapons in the black market, and I buried them between Tunis and Egypt. And just designed my own evacuation plans, put comms kit there, put money there, and just spent a month just designing these plans. And we lived in Aberdeen in Scotland, which is the Houston of Europe. So big oil and gas capital. I'd sold it to a couple of the oil and gas companies. 2012, when your American ambassador got killed in Benghazi, I was there that evening, and I single-handedly got an oil company, German oil company, from Benghazi to Tripoli. 2 years later, I then get a phone call, a Tripoli war, which is a civil war between the militias and the government was going on, from the Canadian embassy saying, look, your name keeps coming up. We're stuck here in Tripoli. Can you help us? So I flew back in and assisted them and single-handedly got 18 military and 4 diplomats evacuated the Canadian embassy from Libya back to Tunis. So that was my day in, day out job.
You know,
So I came home from that trip. Alana sort of highlighted I'd only been home 21 days in a whole 365-day year. Soon realized I hadn't really come to terms with the fact that I'd left the Special Forces. You know, I was still trying to match that adrenaline rush.
Mm-hmm.
And it could have easily gone wrong. You know, they were very successful operations. And a lot of it, as we've touched on, you know, sounds very sexy in Hollywood, was actually understanding demographics, the politics, the tribal influences, understanding what's going on the ground. It wasn't actually that exciting. It's just knowing who to talk to.
Yeah, communication.
Open the doors, communication, and get through. The British Embassy got shot at the week before at every checkpoint. And it's only 100 kilometers from Tripoli to the border. So I went out with my fixer, who was a 50-year-old internet shop owner from UK. You know, he wasn't even from Libya, but he was Libyan. But he was from the same tribes. And, you know, we just spoke to the tribal elders, just told them what we were doing. It was all about respect, communication, and things like that. So, you know, that was the success of that. But as you touched on, you know, Alana's like, right, something needs to change. You know, my book, I think we're chapter 16 now, it's called Dead or Divorced. This is the T-junction I'm at in my life. So, I said, well, look, Alana was a property developer. She said, look, come work with her. My injured leg now was 2 kilos lighter than my good leg because of the muscle wastage. We're talking about 5-year period now from the original injury.
Yeah.
So I just bought a push bike, a road bike, you know, and just cycled to and from the office. Only about 8 miles there, 8 miles back. Straight away, being physically active again, like you were touching on earlier with your running, you like to, you know, just drift away and things like that. I felt this big weight off my shoulders. So you can imagine me sat in these architects and planners meetings with my wife after just telling you some of those stories. You know, I wasn't really interested in any of anything they were saying. It was more the coffee and the biscuits. And so Alana could see that glaze over my eyes and said, right, you need to do something. And I said, well, I've always fancied doing a world record. It was about a month before my 40th birthday. And she said, well, what in? I said, well, cycling seems to be good because it's not aggravating my knee. And so I was thinking maybe, you know, one end of Scotland to the other, or maybe the width of Scotland. And Alana then found the world's longest road, which runs from southern Argentina to northern Alaska. It's 14,000 miles over 14 countries, two continents. So she clearly wanted me out of the house at this point. So that's what I did. Having only cycled 20 miles, sounds quite arrogant. I applied for the world record to Guinness, and they came back 6 weeks later and said, yes, you've been successful on your application. So that was the challenge I'd set myself. But for me, I wanted to do something that was going to mentally and physically engage me, but also take me out of my comfort zone. I'm not a cyclist, you know, but, you know, I knew from my time in the military, I had the endurance, I had the sort of the right mindset, but it's just doing what I've done before, but just on a different discipline.
Yeah. Now that's the part that's amazing is, and you just nailed it, that mindset piece, like something, hey, I've never really done this, but fuck it. It's 14,000 miles. No big deal. Let's do it. Yeah. Most people would probably go, that dude's crazy. But the reality is like that mental aspect is key to then starting and then finishing, starting and finishing so many things in life. I mean, it's really just putting your mind to it and going for it. Now, I'm guessing you didn't really train for it. You just kind of decided, all right, I need some bicycles and what? So tell me how that went.
No, so I did train for years. So I did that. And then, you know, one thing we know, which you touched on earlier, yeah. I've got a good relationship with Prince Harry. Him and I met each other 15 years ago on a military training course. So him and I have been doing a lot of work in the charity sector before. And so I rang him up. I said, look, I'm going to cycle the world's longest road. You know, what campaign should we do it for? So he was just about to launch a campaign called Heads Together, which focuses on mental health. And I'd seen mental health issues with some of the guys in the military, you know, firsthand, but I wasn't aware how big it was an issue throughout the whole of society, be it postnatal depression, young children, teenagers, all the way through to fully grown adults.
Yeah.
So I was like, perfect. So we had the campaign, the challenge, the ride, and we had the campaign, the message, what we were trying to do. And the message was to try and promote it. Physical activity helps your mental state. So I set a target of £1 million I wanted to raise. The world record was 117 days. I was aiming for 110. And I just trained for a year. You know, I got on the bike. You know, I was trying to learn as much as I could from magazines and things like that, but I wasn't getting those finer details I needed to make execute a good plan. So one of the things we do in Special Forces, you know, is as soon as you come off the ground and do it, it's called a hot debrief. And it was what worked, what didn't work. And if we're going to do that again, what would we do differently?
Right.
So I thought, well, the best people to ask are those that have done it before me. So I reached out to the previous record holders and asked them those questions. And they all started in Alaska and finished in South America. And all their, and when I say South America, I mean the very bottom of Argentina, you know, Tierra del Fuego. And so but all their issues were in South Central America, bureaucracy, languages, spares for the bikes. And so for me, being a military guy, and I thought, well, why take a gamble with the second half of the challenge? Why would you not address those early, get them out of the way? And then when you get to North America, you're on the home straight. So one of the things I was quite proud of, I actually turned it on its head 180. I decided I was going from south to north, the opposite of that. But, you know, we're very fortunate in the military to have been in the Arctic, the desert, the jungle and things like that. But I'd never done it on a bike. So I was trying to replicate those scenarios. So Chile, the Atacama Desert, is the driest non-popular desert in the world. It was 44 degrees centigrade. For a week when I was there, you know, it was the height of the summer. I mean, you've got Alaska, which was minus 18 degrees centigrade. So I had all the climates I'd be going through. But to replicate that, I went to Dubai and did heat training there. So I knew that when it came to the day of the race that I could, you know, underdress, cycle that. So I was trying to replicate those before we got on the ground. But, you know, we had a plan. You know, the plan was 110 days, but the plan changed day after day after day, whether it was weather, whether it was third party, whether it was, you know, other things out of our control. So it was a good challenge for me.
Yeah, no doubt. Sounds like one hell of a ride. So what are you averaging each? I mean, how much mileage for each day did you kind of have in your head, like to stay on schedule? I got to do at least 100 and what?
Yeah. So I had it, I called it the Oracle. You know, we had the Oracle, which was what we had to do each day. We had it on paper, we had it on digital. So the world record, like I said, was 117. I was aiming for 110. The first week I was, we had 40 mile an hour winds, crosswinds in Argentina. And I was about 39 miles behind target after the first week, but I was still a week ahead of the world record. After that, the winds sort of changed then. And then the winds were in my favor. The weather was good. And I was doing gains. So I was well ahead of where I should be. So South America, the world record was 58 days. I did it in 48 days. So I was 10 days off that world record. So nice. I was in a great position going into Central America in the second half of the challenge. So I think the original answer to your question, I think it was something like 114 miles a day was what we were looking at originally.
Oh, okay.
But when I got to like some Peru, I got food poisoning twice in Peru, but the wind was behind me. It's 2,500 kilometers of tailwind. So I was now physically and mentally stronger. So anything less than 150 miles a day wasn't enough for me, you know what I mean? But then I got to Texas. I got to Del Rio.
Yeah.
On day 70. I got into Del Rio on day 17. I was 14 days ahead of the world record. So yeah. I'm like, perfect. You know, we are flying now, you know.
Yeah.
So, but my wife, Alana, you know, as mentioned to you before, she's the brains behind this. She runs the whole campaign and things like that. She's very much keeps things out of my way so I can just concentrate on the job. So I had 5 missed calls off her when I got into Texas. And so I'm thinking straight away, there's a problem with the kids. So I ring her up and she said, look, we've been invited to Harry and Meghan's wedding, the biggest event of the year, the royal wedding. I was like, all right.
Yeah.
So I didn't think of it. And I was like, all right. She goes, no, you don't understand. She goes, you need to be in Prudhoe Bay by day 102. That's 15 days ahead of the world record. So going into the phone call, I was 14 days ahead. 10 minutes later, I'm now a day behind. So you can imagine my response was a bit mixed. But
yeah.
Then we got to Lubbock the next day and we had 60 mile an hour winds and tornadoes. So I was now grounded for another 24 hours. But there's an app on your phone called Windy TV, which is very popular with sailors. It gives you the strengths and directions of the winds forecasted every hour for the next 2 weeks, about 95% accurate. So I just played chess with Mother Nature. I just wrote a new plan. I did the majority of my cycling at night in America because the winds had subsided. And the amount of highway patrol that stopped me at 2 or 3 in the morning wondering what the hell I was doing. So I played chess with Mother Nature, also using it to my advantage. Got to Cheyenne in Wyoming, picked up a tailwind, did 260 miles cycling in 11 hours with 10,000 feet of climbing. So originally, yeah, I had 17 days planned for North America. I did it in 11 and a half days. So I then get to, I will get to your answer soon about the average.
It's all right.
I then get to a town called Whitehorse. And one of my friends made me aware of this professional cyclist. So I don't see myself as a professional cyclist. Who's just come out. He's got 3 other world records, you know, sponsored by Red Bull, all the big brands. He's come out on social media and said that he's going to cycle this road in August and be the first person to do it under 100 days. How's that? Fucking great. So that every time I hit an objective, the objective kept moving.
Yeah.
So I wasn't going to rest on those laurels. I thought, well, no, I'm just going to give it my all. So I cycled for 22 hours in the last 30 hours in minus 18 degrees centigrade to come in 99 days, 12 hours and 56 minutes. So that wasn't the original plan, but that's how it ended up. And we had 5 days off, 3 due to weather and 2 due to logistics. So your question, my average miles was 94 days, 147 miles a day.
Ah, there we go. Okay. Yeah.
But that wasn't the original plan, like I said.
Right. You know,
the plan. And I think the success of this operation or this challenge was having a plan, an initial plan, but actually our special forces background, things never go to plans. The plan doesn't survive first contact.
Right.
It was being reactive to the situation as it came to me. And it's been having a bit of flexibility in the plan and just changing it on the ground. So even the very last day, it was changing to
right.
make sure that I got in and under the 100 days.
Yeah, that is awesome and a great accomplishment. So congrats to you. And yeah, yes. I agree, man. It's like a plan is only as good as the first shot fired, as we know. But it's good to have one because it gives you a baseline and then you know how to adjust from there based on what's standing in front of you or what you're dealing with, obstacles. And, you know, for you, it was thousands of miles of road and people and cultures. And I can't even imagine, but... That's an awesome story. Now, of course, we gotta. You've mentioned Prince Harry twice now, and I know that people take advantage of that Prince Harry thing when it comes to you.
Yeah.
So I tread lightly here, but I do remember when we were working together in Australia, I was like, so how did the Prince Harry thing come about with you? We will be right back after the break. So how did the Prince Harry thing come about with you? And you told me an interesting story how you guys first met. You're at a close air support school. You were sitting in the back and he comes walking in and, you know, it was kind of hush hush and you were kind of like, eh, fuck off. And then you became good friends, right?
Yeah, it was similar. I probably didn't say fuck off, but yeah, it wasn't far from it. I was on a JTAC. We're on a JTAC course. But this was before his first tour to Afghanistan. So his commanding officer took a risk, said, look, you can't just come to Afghanistan. You need a job title to go away, do the FAC course, and then you can be the regimental FAC. So that's how he was on that course. But we, you know, this course is like a little hut at the end of the runway on an Air Force base. The Air Force don't even care about the Army. But on this, you can imagine this day, every man and his dog turned up for the opening address just to get some face time.
Right.
So there was 18 of us on course. There was four SF students, two from the SES and SBS. And we sort of commandeered the back of the room as we do.
Yeah.
And everyone did their opening address. Harry then left the room. Then we were told, look, you know, you treat him like one of your own. He doesn't get any sort of preferential treatment. Is that funny? So he comes back in and then the first lecture is call signs. So on the course, you're jackpot 1 to jackpot 1-8. So the pilot knows which student he's talking to. And then when you get to your units, you have your own prefix, you know. So like for the SBS, we're Mayhem, you know, SES is Widowmaker. So Harry puts his hand up and he said, you know, if successful on this course, do I get my own call sign? And I just blurted out, yeah, you're Fox Piss 1. Under my breath, and you could see sort of everyone's face like, how dare you? I mean, he turned around, smiled, but then the sergeant major then came in that afternoon. He said, right, I've randomly picked these jackpot numbers. You'll be working with me, and the rest will be with color sergeant, whoever. So there's 18 on course. He randomly picked four. One was me, one was the SES guy, an RAF officer, and Harry. And I thought he randomly picked them four. And then the other 14 went over to the other group. I was like, this is obviously, you know, he just wanted his own little group. But then you then get paired off again, you know, so you're in working pairs. So him and I worked together. And like I said, he didn't get any preferential treatment. You know, he's a great operator, you know, very confident, clear on the net. You know what I mean? So he was good, mate. He was good. And I think they knew that just sticking with that SBS guy, he's not going to give him any preferential treatment. And I think, you know, I always say, you know, a lot of people ask about it in the military, you know, that's probably the closest he could be to a normal civilian or, you know, not doing his job, not being scrutinized by the media or whatever. He could be, you know, at that point, you're second Lieutenant Wales, you know what I mean, rather than Prince Harry. So,
yeah, I'm sure he, I got to assume that he loved every minute of it. For that reason, you know, he's just kind of with the guys doing guys stuff and not having to worry about all that other bullshit. You know, I can imagine
it's like
a vacation for him, even though it was a full-time job being a military officer and representing the royalty properly.
And he's not in line to be king. So unlike his brother, he had the option. He could go to war. You know what I mean? So, and you know, he did two tours of Afghanistan. So, hats off to him.
Yeah. And so, well, you ended up going to the wedding. I know I've seen pictures, and we're going to use that picture to advertise you, of course. Like, we're going to exploit the shit out. In fact, I'm going to talk to the producers. We're just going to put a picture of Prince Harry and then put Dean Stott on the page. Yeah. How's that?
Yeah, well, that's the problem. As we discussed at the beginning of this show, it doesn't matter how many world records you got, how many billions you've raised for charity. Yeah. I did get to mention we raised $1.3 billion for mental health as well.
Damn, that's awesome.
In the process of that buy ride. It's all about I'm just known as Prince Harry's Special Forces friend. You know, I've been called a lot worse in my time, so I'll take it.
Yeah, it's not a bad association, I'd guess. And now, yeah. I mean, hell, he's like, I think, where does he live? He's living there in L.A. or he's in Canada? I hear a different.
No, he's up the road in Montecito, yeah, just outside of L.A.
Yeah, that's right. That's pretty cool. Well, I won't dig any more on that just because everybody else is, even though they're like, no, ask him more questions about that time when he got naked and they took pictures of him on a balcony. But we'll just stay away from it.
I wasn't there, so I can't comment.
You were the one taking the pictures, I'm sure.
Yeah.
All right, so jumping into your book, right? I mean, you've got a great book, Relentless. You didn't send me a copy or else I would hold it up right now. So you need to send me a signed copy. But let's talk about it. What took you down the path of putting your experience on paper? And then what's your overall mission with the book?
Yeah, so the book, well, because it's a success in the bike ride, things like that, we then did a book called Relentless, and it's been released in the UK, and the reason you don't have a book is because we're going to launch it US in the spring, so I'm saving that hard copy for you. But it's almost an autobiography of myself. You know, I talk, it's in three stages. The first third is my childhood and the military. You know, I don't divulge into the special forces just to keep the guys safe. And then the middle section is the security industry. You know, we've talked a couple of the projects that I've done there, but you know, when you get requested by certain presidents and prime ministers, I ended up having building a good rapport within the security industry, being the guy known as when others won't, this is the guy you need to speak to. And it wasn't because, and I still today have never had to use a weapon in the security. My approach is very different. It's very, as we touched on, understanding the demographics, using the locals and things like that. So we talk about the security industry and then how we then ended up doing the bike ride. So it's sort of like three phases.
Nice.
Then, and then before I moved to America, and then, you know, then the next book will go from there.
Right.
But the takeaways to the people is that, you know, anything is impossible. Anything is possible, you know, just the right mindset. And that's the thing, you know, I was told that I'd last 2 minutes in the military. You then get to tier one. You then, unfortunately, have an injury. You then become top of the game within the security industry. But then, obviously, to be successful twice, you know, some would say it was lucky, but to then just grab a sport that you've never done before and then become the first person in history to cycle the world's longest road under 100 days at the age of 41, there's obviously a theme between. Yeah. And it is, as you've touched on, it is the mindset and attitude.
That's right. No doubt. It's you hear that, you know, at least on the SEAL side of the house and you talk about buds, you hear it all the time. It's 90% mental, 10% physical. But all people see are videos of the physical, you know, torture going on. But it is the mental game that keeps you there and gets you to the finish line so that then you can move on to the good stuff. But Well, that's sounds like a phenomenal book. And we'll have to bring you back on when it comes out here in the States so that you can, we can dive deep into the book and the book only during that one. And of course, Prince Harry again, you know, we got to always take advantage of him.
I'm going to change my cover. I'm just going to stick him on the front cover. It'll be a bestseller.
Yeah, you should. It should be like half your face, you know, with your arm around him and then the rest is his face. Yeah.
It's called Fox Piss One. We just changed the title.
Yeah, I think you're onto something there, actually. Let's see here. You know, our guys do a good job digging up all kinds of stuff on you. We've touched on a bunch of it. And so right now, living in L.A., back in the United States, you know, what is it that you're doing and kind of got your sights focused on for the future?
Yeah, so we never looked beyond the bike ride. We did it, so I wasn't taking those risks. You know, we've touched on the book. You know, the feedback from the book is like, you're no great endurance athlete, great story, but you are the security guru. You are the security expert. So obviously, I'm still doing a lot of security. Alan and I always wanted to move to America, you know, but we just got distracted. We had kids, you know, did bike rides and stuff like that, as we just touched on.
Right.
So December 19, we decided, right, you know, do we just settle in Scotland or do we look to what our dreams were, which was America? I mean, 3 months later, COVID hit. So we just saw that as an opportunity. You know, that was in March. By October, we were out here as a family, you know, middle of elections, wildfires, and things like that. So we just saw an opportunity come over. And, you know, so what I'm doing now, still doing a lot of the security stuff, just done a hell of a lot of stuff, and still doing a lot of stuff in Afghanistan because of the success of the evacuations I've done in other countries. Mm-hmm. You know, we obviously assisted there, and we've got over 1,000 people out of Afghanistan. So that's still very much. So security is what puts food on the table and my day to day.
Yeah.
We talked about the book getting launched, but then, you know, it's now increasing that media profile. You know, before I had my anonymity, you know, no one knew who I was, but now it's like, you know, you are a public figure, you got a world record holder and things like that. So juggling a bit of media, but also still keeping my toe dipped in the security sector.
Yeah. I mean, our last conversations when you're overseas together is, you were planning a next world record. You're still doing that, right? That's yeah. So where are we at with the Nile River?
Yeah. So my USP, like, I'm not a cyclist. So, and my wife tells me she didn't marry me because I look like Lance Armstrong. So I want to take a sport that I've never done before and just find the biggest challenge. So I've been on a Klepper in the SBS, but I've not done any sort of kayaking. So I've cycled the world's longest road. The aim is to then paddle the world's longest river, which is the River Nile, 4,280 miles from Rwanda to Egypt. So we are going to do the Nile. We've put the Nile to the right because 2022 is a big year in more media exposure, because it doesn't matter, sad to say, it doesn't matter how many world records you've got, or how many millions you've raised for charity. In the current climate, it's like, well, how many Instagram followers has he got? Has he done any TV and things like that? So this year is going to be more focused on building that profile up, doing more TV work. And then what it then does is brings more eyes to the Nile project.
Yeah, I gotcha. Yeah. I told you, if you needed someone to hang out for 30 days while you're cruising that thing, because you're projecting, what, 90 to 100 days to basically paddle that thing, right?
Yeah, I'm thinking about 40 miles a day paddling. Yeah. So probably the same approach as the bike ride. You know, set a target, and if I can come in on the 100 days again, it'd be perfect.
Yeah. Well, like I said, if you need someone to drive the chase vehicle off on the shoreline there, I'm your man.
I'll definitely need a sniper as well for those crocodiles and hippos, mate.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, you're going to be, it's a whole lot of different wildlife. And there's even sections I hear that you'll have to actually get up and just drag your boat, you know, behind you.
Yeah, because anything you can't paddle, you port it, so you just carry. But you know, as we touched on there, you've got the wildlife element, you've got civil war in South Sudan. You know, there's a reason, unlike the bike ride where I could speak to previous record holders, no one's ever done this before, you know, so we're not going in blind. We've got a good team around us who know the area. But, yeah. you know, I'm saying to you now, I'll paddle 40 miles a day. It'll be different.
Yeah, it'll be different. Yeah. Well, you'll probably get further some days and shorter the others.
Exactly.
And that's just how it rolls, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, so yeah, you know, we've done a very, very snapshot of everything you got going on. Obviously, your book, Relentless, is a place to get the details. Special operations, special forces guy, security expert, done some great stuff, getting people out of embassies and stuff around the globe. Obviously breaking world records. And now, okay, this is going to be your biggest challenge, is your hypothetical survival scenario that we built just for you. Okay.
Wow.
Now I'm going to tell you ahead of time, there's right answers and wrong answers, but the only one that matters is our answer. Okay. So you can rationalize all fucking day long and it doesn't matter, Dean. Okay. You're either going to be right or wrong according to, the story maker. All right. So are you ready?
Yes, please.
Okay, here we go. You're listening to Can You Survive This Podcast? Thanks for tuning in. Please make sure to subscribe, rate, and share on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your favorite shows. All right, so you're in a foreign country on a job for a very private, high net worth client, okay? The city is unnamed, but it's densely populated and urban. A whole lot of new wealth, but massive poverty. Okay, sound familiar? Yes. There are dense clusters of large new buildings and tenants all crammed into a very, you know, confined area. You've been flown into the city one day early before your actual security gig. Okay. You're at a hotel. It's not very nice. Okay. But it's the night before your job. You're winding down, kind of taking a moment before you start your gig the next day. And by the way, how do you wind down? You get into hotel. Do you have any, like, you know, do you have a routine when you get into hotel rooms or?
I don't really. My wind down is when the job is over.
Yeah.
And I'm out of country. No, that's my wind down. Yeah.
Yeah, I agree. It's got to stay alert the whole time. So it's the night before the job starts. Okay. Now you're kind of relaxing. And, you know, maybe prepping is probably the better thing we all do is you're prepping for your next day and you hear banging at your door. Okay. And someone shouts, "This is the police. You're under arrest for robbing those banks. Open the door." Okay. So first question. All right. And now if you were sitting here in person, but because you came to Dallas and didn't tell me, and now you're in LA and now we're doing the show, which is bad on you to come to Dallas. On the screen here, we've got your first question. So do you keep the door closed and sneak out the window, or B, request that they hold their credentials up at the peephole?
I'm in the B, because I don't want to inflate the situation. But what I always do, and I always have with me when I'm on trips, is a door wedge, a 99 cents door wedge, because you don't know who has access to these hotel cards.
Yeah.
So I always stick that behind the door.
Hell
just
yeah.
In case they did have their own swipe engines. But I don't want to inflate. I know that I haven't robbed anyone, so I don't want to sort of inflame the situation.
Right. You don't want to fire them up. And I do the same. I think that's a little trick in the security world that us security guys know, is I carry four of the little wooden wedges that come in the, it's a Slim Jim kit. I don't know if you've seen those. To Jimmy the door open, you have these long reach tools. And they have the perfect, like, wooden wedges that you can get through security. You don't have to worry, because it's not metal and all that. And then, you know, you can do one or two at the top, two into this on the lock side, and one at the bottom. And, you know, it's going to keep people out for sure. That's a great point, man. And you are correct, B, right? Since you haven't done anything wrong, there's no need to run and be arrested or fleeing. I mean, that's just going to make you look guilty. They're two officers. They're in proper uniform. They flash their credentials. So everything looks legit at this point. So good job. All right. So next. Do you tell them they've made a mistake and to go away, or B, you know, crack the door, give in a little bit. You've got the lock on the door, but you can crack it just a little bit and confirm everything.
Yeah, I'd go B. I think I'd wait to see what their initial reaction was from me asking for the credentials. And if they've shown me, then yeah, I'll crack the door again. It's trying to not inflame that situation, but obviously conscious that, you know, you need to react if need be.
Right. And I think you follow some of the same principles when you were in the military. There's a big difference. Like in the military, for me, in a lot of these countries I was operating in, I didn't pull over for police. I didn't open fucking doors for police. Police were basically equivalent to bad guys. But as a civilian, you got to kind of treat things a whole lot different, because you don't have, you don't have the 800-pound gorilla of the United States military, you know, backing you up one border away. You know what I mean? Cracking the door, and it's kind of a give, right? It's kind of like giving them a little bit of something to keep them satisfied. Yeah.
True.
So B, yes, correct. All right. So next one. The police ask if they can come in and ask you some questions. So, A, let them in, or B, tell them to come back with a warrant and shut the door. You're in someone else's country, so.
Yeah.
It's a tough one.
If there was a third option, I'd ask if we could go into the public lobby and just chat there.
It's a great point. Yep.
Again, Again, they're not going to come back with a warrant. I've worked in some of these places, you know. Again, try and I'll go with the A.
Yeah,
let them in.
And yes, A is correct. And I'm with you because you and I both know the legal systems really only work in one, two, maybe three countries on this fucking planet. It's corrupt. I mean, it's corrupt. It's semi-permissive if you're lucky. And the law enforcement, certainly bribery and taking cash and all that is like a primary form of income for these folks, right?
Yeah, true. I sort of learned as well, especially like going around, because I worked all over Africa and the Middle East, is that the laws that we have in UK and America are for UK and America. You can't enforce them in another country.
Yeah.
So people used to ask me questions about buying weapons on the black market. It's legal. I've done nothing illegal there. You know, it's all legal in that country.
If I
did it in UK, it'd be totally illegal.
Yeah.
So yeah, you need to understand, and as you touched on, before you go to these countries, you understand their cultures, their laws and things like that. So you don't get tripped up as well. And you understand that is normal. Is it normal in the US and isn't normal in the UK, but it is normal in wherever we are at the
right
moment.
In those countries, you know, they don't call them black markets. They're called open air markets. You walk up and you buy whatever the fuck you want.
It's or the not hotel until, manager.
It's not until you leave the country you go, oh yeah, those I guess were considered black markets, but they're just open air markets. They're like a souk. A souk of weapons. Yeah, I'm with you, man. That's good stuff. So yeah, you let them in. All right. They tell you that they need your passport. Okay. This is where, you know, this is the part that bugs me even in real life. You know, anybody who needs my passport. So they say, hey, we need your passport and you got to come with us. And so do you A, refuse and request to call your embassy, or B, cooperate with the police and go ahead and, you know, give them your passport?
So what I always do, and I do it when I do my travel security to people. Before I go anywhere, I take photocopies of my passport. I take photocopies of my yellow fever cards and things like that. So when you have, when people ask you, especially some of these hotels you go to around the world, oh, we need to take your passport to get it scanned. Well, here, I've already got a photocopy. So that should do the job. So you never lose sight of your passport. So that was what I would do in this situation.
Yeah.
I keep my passport on me, but I would give them my photocopy, because then you've actually agreed to what they've asked.
Yep.
You've given them what they need.
Yep.
And without upsetting them. So I always have photocopies for those scenarios.
Yeah. Okay. I like it. And that's all great points. And I think it's stuff that even if you go to the statedepartment.gov here in the United States, you know, you go there, it's going to tell you all these things. It really does. It's a great source. You know, another great source of information is if you're going to, let's say, whatever that country is, go to that country's embassy websites. Every single one of them have embassy websites now. We tend to go, oh, I'm just going to look at American stuff, even though I'm traveling to Egypt. It's like, no, go to the Egyptian consulate website, and they will tell you exactly what the do's and don'ts, which is a much better source of information. So, yeah, that's good stuff. So you get your passport, and the police demand to escort you to their vehicle, and now they've got their guns drawn. Really odd.
Yeah.
Really odd. This is kind of a weird place. So you're about to be placed into their SUV. So do you A, strike and evade and run down the nearby alley? Mm-hmm. Or B, once again, cooperate because everything looks legit. Get into the vehicle and ask where you're being taken.
Again, B, you've started building up a rapport with these guys. You don't want to lose that. Although your natural instinct, it won't feel comfortable.
No, not
but
at
I'm
all.
Going with B. I'll go with B.
Yeah. So. And plus, you like risk. Fuck it. Why not? Let's see what let's see what these guys are capable of.
I've probably already sized the two of them up anyway.
Yeah, exactly. You know, it's only a fair fight when it's three versus one frogman, right? I mean, that's what we say.
Exactly.
All right. So you continue to cooperate because, hey, once again, you haven't committed a crime. You've done nothing wrong. And these guys look legit. Now you're in the vehicle. The police, they say that they're taking you to a police station for questioning. One of them has your passport, obviously. The road ahead is blocked. The traffic has kind of come to a slow crawl. All right. Policemen become frustrated, and one of them says, you know, fuck it, let's just shoot him and dump his body. Okay. The other officer kind of nods in agreement. So do you A, plead with them and tell them they don't have to do this. You don't have to do this. Come on. We can all be friends. Or B, unlock the door and jump out of the vehicle while the traffic is nice and slow.
I need to get my passport back.
Yeah, you are thinking ahead. Yeah, I got to get my passport back.
And I take it there in front of me, these two guys.
Yeah, you've got the advantage.
Yeah, I've got the advantage. When they say, I'd plead with them still. Until I see someone actually go for something, I'm not going to react yet.
So you're saying A. All right, let's see what the screen says here. Hold on. Ooh, B. Yeah. You were going down. Okay. I saw it. You were going to say B. So B, unlock the door and jump out of the vehicle.
Okay.
Yeah, so that's all right. Now that the cops, now that the cops have alluded to offing you off, I mean, you have good reason to go, hey, my life has been threatened. I'm getting the fuck out of here. and you personally have already mentioned you've got copies and, you know, passport wise, you're probably okay. But you decide to get off the X and get away from it as quickly as possible. You run down an alley. Do you A, hide under a dumpster, or B, duck low and move with the crowd of pedestrians?
Move with the pedestrians.
See what the answer? Yes. B, duck low and move with the crowd of pedestrians. And yeah, the reason, blend in, be gray. Like you mentioned, like selection, be the gray guy. That extends through the rest of your freaking life. be the gray guy. Yeah.
I know my like the dumpster move and run me over.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. They're on wheels these days. And so when it comes to blending in, what's your philosophy on that?
Obviously, especially for me, being follicly challenged, the white man all over Africa and the Middle East.
Yeah.
But I just don't, you know, I'm quite relaxed in this situation. Obviously, I have great fixers with me and we go to places that aren't so high risk. You know, we'll make an assessment before we go there. We think, no, it's too dangerous. We just don't do it. You know, one thing about the security industry, you've gone from, especially our background, from known as being like the bravest in the world to the biggest cowards. But the best people in security are those who can preempt or pre-read a situation. You know, I used to hear guys, we had this firefight in Iraq. And I was like, well, you've done your job wrong. You know, it's been able to preempt and avoid any sort of conflict and scenarios. So that's what I tend to do. I'll make a ground assessment. If we don't think it's safe enough, we just won't go. So I'll probably know before I stepped off out the vehicle what the area is like. But again, you know, things happen as well. So expect the worst. Always expect the worst.
That's right. That's right. That's good information. Yeah. And for those of you listening, you know, blending in and being the gray person is sometimes difficult for Americans because our ego dresses us each day. You know, we literally look in our closet and our drawers and we go, yeah, what sets me apart from everyone else and makes me look good at the same time? Which are the two things that will make you stand out overseas every day of the week. And so it's best to win in Rome, like the saying goes, just dress and look exactly the part of everyone else and you will blend in. And as long as you're already dressed that way, then if one of these moments, you know, you get yourself into a crisis, well, then you're already dressed to blend in.
And don't have any shiny things, as you touched on there. I'll have my 5/11 watch rather than my decent night watch. And glasses. I used to wear a lot of guys used to wear, you know, Oakleys and Gaiters and things like that. But I don't. For me, I never wear sunglasses because I like to see people that see my eyes. I know that I've got their attention and they've got mine as well. So actually it's a nonverbal communication. So that itself, you know, used to go to places like Nigeria and you'd see them, the chances you made, you can talk about opportunity, but once you clock them, that's it. That's their opportunity gone. So that's one thing I always found that I didn't do, is I didn't wear sunglasses.
Yeah, I've noted the same thing. The biggest reason for me, not so much on the visibility side, but more so because you look around and no one else is wearing sunglasses as much as Americans and Brits. Like, we're like the only ones that wear sunglasses. So if you want to stand out, put on your sunglasses.
Yeah.
But, and the same with these type of ball caps I'm wearing, right?
Yeah.
No one's wearing these except Americans.
No.
So you got to shed all of that American stuff so that you can blend in a whole lot easier. But I say American, but it also, you know, Brits love this stuff too. We're one in the same these days. Okay, moving on. So next question. So you've ducked low. You've moved with the crowd. Hiding nearby will leave you a sitting duck. So you got to keep moving. The two cops are on foot now. They split up to try and find you. As you move from cover to cover, right, taking advantage of your environment, the cop that took your passport suddenly ends up with his back turned right in front of you, right? Imagine crowded area, T intersection, you're approaching it, and you all of a sudden you see him like, oh, and his back is turned because he's looking for you ahead of him, right? So do you A, knock him out and take your passport, or sneak away and make your way to the embassy?
Difficult one. B.
Let me see here. Let's see what the magic answer. Oh, B, I mean, B is right because we, the reason being is because you've already mentioned copies of passport. You've already.
And I always have two passports as well. I forgot to mention that. You know, and it's, you know, with some guys, I have three.
Yeah.
So it's like we're not maybe for these scenarios, but.
Right. That's why we do these scenarios. The answer is getting right and wrong is definitely a part of it, but. This discussion is exactly why, because the listeners are benefiting from this 1,000%, which is the goal.
And I think the reason I say B is because, as you know, in these countries, there's a lot of corruption and things like that. So it's your word against the police. If I then assault a policeman, they have reason then to arrest me. They don't have a reason before that.
Right. That's a good point. And so
that's why I would sneak away. That was my thought process on that.
Yeah. Well, it's a good thought process, but the frogman in you decided to punch him in the back of the head and you knocked his ass out and you took your passport back. So, you know, once again, it can go either way, but you need your passport, because that's your ticket into the embassy, as we both know. So you knock him out, you got your passport. All right. So now do you A, change your appearance or go ahead and steal the cop's SUV? Change your appearance and just keep on foot, or steal the SUV. Is it the civilized?
Well, you've already committed. You've already knocked out a policeman now, so you may as well steal his SUV.
Yeah. I mean,
stealing his SUV.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it goes with the saying I always throw out there: bad decisions make for great stories. I mean,
yeah. I'll steal his SUV. It's a great story in the bar with the lads.
Let's see what the game has in store for you. You're going with B. Steal the cop's SUV. Yeah, and here it's change your appearance. You're taking the safe route, but that's okay. I like your answer. Fuck it. Stealing their car could only bring more attention. Yeah, you know, but that's the frogman way. You can steal clothes. You can take your clothes off. Whatever you think that works for blending in and moving through the crowd and getting back over to the embassy. But hey, it's okay. We're going to steal the car. Fuck it.
Depends where the embassy is. You know, if it's 30 miles, it's the SUV. If it's around the corner,
Right. That's true, too. But we don't put any of that kind of information in here because it's the whole point is to throw you off a little. All right. Last question. All right. So you go into the store. You buy some cheap goods that you can help disguise yourself with, you know, and blend in. And now you're a little more deceptive when other cops come looking for you. So last question, do you, A, take the knocked out cop's gun, okay, and go get the other cop before he gets you, or B, discreetly make your way to the embassy? B is always a popular answer in these. Or choice.
I'll discreetly make my way to the embassy now.
Yes, that is correct. It wouldn't be wise to waste any more time in that area. Like, just get the hell out of there. Even with the frogman in you coming out, or more, the more civilized approach that you took, you only missed. What is that? Two questions. So an 80. So good job. You, Dean Stott, have survived this podcast.
Brilliant. Thank you so much.
Right now, the sound effects.
Yeah.
Everybody's cheering for you. Okay. So, hey, man, it was great hanging out with you. So where can everybody find Dean Stott and everything you've got going on?
Yeah, so obviously I'm on the social media, normal social medias, Instagram, Facebook, not so much on Twitter, but I do have an account. And then you have Dean Stott, www.deanstott.com, which is my website. And we're just about to start really populating that now with the book sales, more media stuff as well. So on either of them, you will find out what I'm doing.
Awesome. So there you go, everyone. Go look for him, deanstott.com. That's Stott. And he's on social media. In fact, I follow him. So to make it easy, you can go to my followers or who I'm following and, you know, follow all those folks that have been on the show. Once again, look for his book, Relentless, coming out spring, summertime, right?
Spring.
And we'll try and get you back on the show again so we can dive deep into that book. But correct me if I'm wrong, they can get on Amazon right now and still buy your book.
They can get on Amazon now. It's taking, because of the shipping issues with COVID, it's taking about 5 to 6 weeks. So we've actually Americanized the book as well. So
yeah.
the changed a lot of the grammar, you know, the Zs to the Ss and things like that. I mean, you know, I had some great people endorse the book in UK, but no, they won't know them here stateside. So we've got some great American names here. So Bear Grylls, Jocko Willink, Admiral McRaven, and things like that. So people that you guys in America would recognize.
Right. No, that's good, man. I think that's a great idea. You're right. Why is it that the Brits don't like Zs? We put Zs, you guys put Ss. What is that? What's the deal with that?
Yeah, no, I mean, obviously we all stem from the English language, but it doesn't help. With Apple automatically puts on Z anyway, so it was actually quite easy to edit.
Yeah. Well, Apple's an American company. There you go.
Yeah, exactly.
It's the proper English here in America, god damn it. All right, well, hey everyone, go check out Dean Stott. Thank you for coming on the show, buddy. deanstott.com. that's Dean, deanstott.com. and like I always say, keep it simple, because crisis will complicate the rest. And until next time, be safe out there. Can You Survive This Podcast is a production of Calvary Audio and iHeartMedia. Recorded live from a secure location here in Dallas, Texas. Produced by Brandon Morgan, Jeff Apple, and Clint Emerson. Executive produced by Keegan Rosenberger and Dana Brunetti. For Calvary Audio, I'm Clint Emerson.